Blog Talk Radio.
Promotes health awareness through our weekly discussion. Healthy 365 does not provide medical advice. Please consult your health provider for all your medical concerns and needs. Good evening, friends. Welcome to tonight's edition of Healthy 365. I'm your host, Nicole Lee, and today we'll be talking about ovarian cancer, which kind of ties into our topic from last week, which was PCOS, which also was a condition of the ovaries. I want to welcome everyone on this Sunday. Today's November 5th, and I'm broadcasting live from the Tennessee Valley. Today, I don't know, a lot of us are kind of get our bearings together because of falling back. So if you're not already aware, we set the clocks back, which gave us an additional hour, but it's actually, it would typically be a little bit later today. So, you know, I know that takes some adjusting for all of us. Also, I was kind of amused with all of my social media friends that were waiting for the blackout for us to not have lights and not have cellular service and data. I can't stress enough to really just be cautious with the influx of false information that's out there and people doing all types of videos and things that just aren't real. So really do your research and kind of check your facts. And there was no blackout. We're all still conversing with each other, which is great because I'm glad you're all joining this evening. Let's kind of talk about ovarian cancer. And I got this definition from the American Cancer Society. And according to them, ovarian cancer is a cancer that begins in the ovaries. And so just to recap, the ovaries are reproductive glands and they're found only in women. And the ovaries produce eggs or ova for reproduction, and the egg basically travels through the fallopian tube to the uterus where it is fertilized, and then it implants and develops into a fetus, which later becomes a baby. The ovaries are also the main source of female hormones, which we talked about last week, which would be estrogen and progesterone, and one ovary is on each side of the uterus in the pelvis. So what kind of made me want to talk about ovarian cancer was I thought to myself, you know, when I go for my annual exam every year, I don't really know, you know, necessarily for certain. I know they talk about cervical cancer. And of course, they, you know, they talk about having a healthy reproductive system. So you're checking for all of those things to make sure everything's working. But then I thought to myself, okay, I don't hear that much about the ovaries. You know, they're like, I guess they're just a part of our body maybe that we take for granted. They're there and, you know, we just take for granted that they'll function well. But I thought to myself, since I lost a relative to ovarian cancer, you know, how do you prevent this? How do you check for it? You know, is somebody automatically doing this? A lot of times the health provider relationship is one where sometimes you can become complacent and just assume, okay, my doctor's doing everything. But I think in the last 15 years, there's really been a movement for us to take charge of our health and to advocate for ourselves and to educate ourselves. And so I think it's really important with the way this cancer is diagnosed and some facts that I wasn't aware of about this type of cancer, it's really important for us more than anything as women or as a community, including our men in our community, to be aware because it actually does not have like a diagnostic test. There's not like a standard test. So I was really shocked to learn. And I'm going to kind of do something a little bit different before I kind of go into an extent like with the the different information about the condition is to kind of talk about some very interesting facts about it. So, okay. September, they said, is National Ovarian Cancer Awareness Month. And the color teal, the ribbon for the awareness month is teal. And that is worn to bring about awareness for ovarian cancer. Now, when I had some photos up for PCOS last week, you'll notice also that the bra was teal for PCOS. So the ovaries, I'm assuming, the color chosen for them would be teal. Some facts here are ovarian cancer is the leading cause of death from gynecologic cancers in the U.S., and it is the fifth leading cause of cancer death amongst women in the U.S. In the U.S. alone, it says there will be approximately 21,980 new cases of ovarian cancer each year, and about 14,270 of those women diagnosed will die from the disease. So that's pretty alarming. It says that there are 186,138 women currently living with ovarian cancer in the U.S. alone. And it is an insidious disease, and it can strike without warning or without cause. So that really, really caused me some alarm and some concern. And it's important to know that the symptoms of ovarian cancer are often vague and subtle, and so therefore it makes it very difficult to diagnose. And it says here that patients are usually diagnosed in advanced stages, and only 45% survive longer than 5 years. And then only 19% of the cases are caught before the cancer has spread beyond the ovary to the pelvic region. So much like other cancers, it can spread. And it says when ovarian cancer is detected and treated early on, the five-year survival rate is greater than 92%. Now, I find that interesting. The Cancer Society, kind of how they monitor things as far as cancer goes, they do it based on a five-year survival rate. So they kind of break everything down into 5 years. And ovarian cancer rates, it says, are highest in women aged 55 to 64. And the median age of diagnosis is 63. The median age of death from ovarian cancer is 70. And ovarian cancer survival rates are much lower than other cancers that affect women. It says here a woman's lifetime risk of ovarian cancer is 1 in 75. So that's 1 in 75 women are at risk for ovarian cancer. Some important things that these organizations that have wonderful resources and information about this condition, it's really important, women, to listen to your body and don't ignore any symptoms. So even something that seems minute or small, or even if it could just be, you know, the bloating could just be bloating just because of your diet or a sensitivity to something within your diet or because it's that time of the month, still kind of let your doctor know about any changes or any symptoms that you notice. So, it says here that when we look into kind of like the anatomy of a woman, so we kind of break it down, and there's a wonderful picture here, and I'm going to include links to all of these resources on my blog. This information is coming from the cancer.org, and this is a website for the American Cancer Society. And it says here that there are three different types of cells in the ovaries. And each type of cell can develop into a different type of tumor. Okay, so there's different types of tumors that can develop. Okay, so the ovaries are made up of three kinds of cells. They're called epithelial, are called epithelial tumors. And this is based on where they're located in the body. So epithelial tumors start from the cells that cover the outer surface of the ovary, and most of the ovarian tumors are epithelial. So this is the most common type of tumors that can develop, okay? There's also something called a germ cell tumor, and it starts from the cells that produce the eggs or ova. So these are cells that, these are tumors that are generated from the cells that actually produce your eggs, okay? And then there's something called stromal tumors, and that's S-T-R-O-M-A-L. And they start from the structural tissue cells that hold the ovary together and produce the female hormones estrogen and progesterone. It says here that most of these tumors are benign, which means non-cancerous, and usually they never spread beyond the ovary. Benign tumors are treated by removing either the ovary or part of the ovary that contains the tumor. However, malignant tumors, which are also known as cancerous tumors, or low malignant potential ovarian tumors, can spread. and a common medical term used for the spread of cancer is called metastasize, okay, to other parts of the body, and it can be fatal. And we'll kind of talk about different treatment options later. And so let's kind of talk about the different types of tumors. And they'll kind of break it down based on, like I said, the most common ones are called benign. They're making sure to include that in it. Benign epithelial ovarian tumors. So most ovarian tumors are benign and they don't spread. So they usually don't lead to serious problems or illnesses. And there are several types of benign epithelial tumors, and these include cystadenomas. Sorry about that. Mucinous cystadenomas and Brenner tumors. So those are three different types of really common benign epithelial ovarian tumors. Say that three times fast, right? There's also some that have low malignant potential. And when you think about what potential means, it means that this type of tumor has the potential to turn into a malignancy, okay? So it can turn into a cancerous tumor, okay? So when they look at these particular tumors, the low malignant potential ones, under a microscope, they notice that some of the ovarian epithelial tumors don't clearly appear to be cancerous. These are called tumors of low malignant potential. So when they're looking at these, you know, when they scrape the cells and they're kind of checking things, like, for example, when you have your pap smear, they actually scrape some cells, okay, and they put them under a microscope, and someone takes a look at these cells. And that's how they test you for cervical cancer, to changes in your cervix. And they'll take a look at those cells and see if there's any indication of changes there that can indicate that there is a condition or there's a likelihood of development of cancer, okay? So when they look at these types of tumors under a microscope, they don't all show signs whether they are cancerous or not. They also said there's something called a borderline epithelial ovarian. There's something also known as borderline epithelial ovarian cancer. And these are different from the typical ovarian cancers because they don't grow into the supporting tissue of the ovary, which is called an ovarian stroma. Likewise, if they spread outside the ovary, like, for example, into your abdominal cavity or your belly, they might grow on the lining of the abdomen, but often don't grow into it. So these low malignant potential tumors tend to affect women that are younger, okay, than the typical ovarian cancers. And these tumors grow slowly and are less life-threatening than most ovarian cancers. It says LMP tumors can be fatal, but this isn't common, okay? So these are like low malignant potential, commonly found in young women, and they grow slowly, okay? Now, there's another type of malignant ovarian tumors, and they're called malignant epithelial ovarian tumors. Now, cancerous epithelial tumors are called carcinoma, okay? So those are known as carcinoma. So carcinoma is a cancerous epithelial tumor. About 85 to 90% of ovarian cancers are this type of cancer. So when someone usually says that they have had ovarian cancer, they usually mean that they had this type of cancer. And these particular tumor cells, they have some specific features when they're viewed under a microscope. And this is how they kind of are classified as an epithelial ovarian carcinoma. Okay, so the serous type is by far the most common, but there are also other types like the mucinous, endometrioid, and clear cell. Okay, so the different types are serous, mucinous, endometrioid, and clear cell, okay? And if the cells don't look like any of these other, like, four types, the four that I just named, then they're known as an undifferentiated tumor. And that just means that they tend to grow and spread more quickly than the other types. Now, epithelial ovarian carcinomas are classified by these subtypes, but they are also given a grade and a stage, okay? So cancer can get complicated. Much like other conditions, it has a stage, but they also grade it, okay? Now, the grade classifies the tumor based on how much it looks like normal tissue on a scale of 1, 2, or 3, okay? So that's the grade of the tumor, how much it looks like normal tissue on a scale of 1, 2, or 3. So a grade 1 epithelial ovarian carcinoma looks very similar to normal tissue, and it tends to have a better prognosis. And prognosis means an outlook, okay? Grade 3 epithelial ovarian carcinomas look less like normal tissue and usually have a worse outlook or prognosis. And grade 2 look and act in between grades 1 and 3. So grade 3 is the worst and the one that has the worst prognosis. Grade 1 is the one that looks most similar to normal tissue. And grade 2 is basically like in between, okay? Now, the tumor stage describes how far the tumor has spread from where it started, okay? So it's important to know what different types of cancer, they're going to name it based on where it started, the place of origin, okay? So epithelial ovarian cancers tend to spread to the lining and organs of the pelvis and the abdomen, okay? That's usually where they go first. This may lead to the buildup of fluid in the abdominal cavity, and that's called ascites, okay? And ascites is spelled A-S-I-T-E-S, and that just means fluid building up in the abdominal cavity. So basically, your stomach is swollen with fluid, okay? And ascites can also be found in people that have other conditions such as liver disease, so liver cirrhosis, and some other conditions. You can cause, like, retention of fluid in the abdominal cavity. As the cancer becomes more advanced, it may also spread to other areas such as the lung and the liver. And on some rare occasions, it will spread to the brain, to the bones, or to the skin. Okay? And then they also talk about staging. Okay? So we'll kind of talk about that in a little bit, about like how they come up with the staging. Okay. Now, there are some other cancers that are very similar to epithelial ovarian cancer. And these are a rare cancer, and they're really they're related to the epithelial ovarian cancer. And so there's primary peritoneal carcinoma, and basically the abbreviation for that is PPC. It's a rare cancer, and it's closely related to the epithelial ovarian cancer. And when someone undergoes surgery, it looks just the same as an epithelial ovarian cancer that has spread through the abdomen, but under a microscope, it looks like that as well under the microscope. And there's other names for this cancer. It's called extra ovarian, meaning outside the ovary, or primary peritoneal carcinoma. So the abbreviation for that would be EOPPC. And then there's also something called a serous surface papillary carcinoma. I've actually seen this diagnosis in a couple of patients. Okay. It says here that primary peritoneal carcinomas seem to develop from cells in the lining of the pelvis and the abdomen. And this lining is called the peritoneum. Okay. So that's the area in between the pelvis and the abdomen, okay, called the peritoneum. Okay, these cells are very similar to the cells on the surface of the ovaries. Some experts believe that PPC may start in the cells lining the fallopian tubes. And like ovarian cancer, PPC tends to spread along the surfaces of the pelvis and the abdomen, so it's often difficult to tell exactly where the cancer started first. It also says that this cancer can occur in women who still have their ovaries, but it's also more common for women who have had their ovaries removed to prevent ovarian cancer. This cancer does rarely occur in men. Okay. So here are some of the symptoms of this particular type of cancer, and then we'll talk about also the symptoms of ovarian cancer, because you'll see like a common occurrence here. So if we look at the symptoms of ovarian cancer, and these are symptoms that were reported by women who had been diagnosed with ovarian cancer. They report the following symptoms. They report that all of these symptoms were a change from their norm in their bodies. And the frequency or number of these symptoms are really key in diagnosing ovarian cancer. There are also several studies that show that an early stage ovarian cancer can produce these symptoms as well. So these are symptoms in both later stages and early stages. But if you look at like the symptom list, I'm going to read them in just a moment. They're very similar, okay? These are like some common things. In fact, I think some of these symptoms were similar to PCOS. For example, bloating is one, okay? Pelvic or abdominal pain, difficulty eating or feeling full quickly, as well as urinary symptoms. So this can be an urgency that you have to urinate or a frequency, so a change in your normal urinary symptoms or pattern. If you have any of these symptoms, they recommend you see a gynecologist, and they last more than 12 times during a course of a month, or they're new or unusual for you. They want you to discuss these with your doctor, preferably a gynecologist, because they specialize in the reproductive symptoms. Now, there's some additional symptoms here of ovarian cancer, and these are a little bit more, you heard me describe before that it's known as like the symptoms are very vague, okay? So here are some additional symptoms, and these are very vague. Fatigue is one. Indigestion is another. Back pain, pain with intercourse, constipation, and menstrual irregularities. Now, these symptoms are not very useful, they said, in identifying ovarian cancer because they're found in equal frequency in women in the general population that don't have the cancer. So you can see, if you just look at the symptoms, the bloating, pelvic or abdominal pain, difficulty eating, feeling full, or the urinary symptoms. I mean, some of these things, like the urinary symptoms, that could simply be a bladder infection or a urinary tract infection. Difficulty eating or feeling full. It could be a whole bunch of different things, like hormonal changes, all kinds of things. Pelvic or abdominal pain. We talked about that last week. Definitely that has something to do. That's a common symptom of PCOS. Bloating is a common symptom of PCOS. Fatigue, these general, that's a common symptom of PCOS. Back pain, pain with intercourse, all these different things. It's just so common with other conditions. Now, if we look at the symptoms of the cancer PPC, so this is the primary peritoneal carcinoma, listen to these symptoms. They're very, very similar. To the ovarian symptoms. Okay, so they are abdominal pain, bloating, nausea, vomiting, indigestion, and a change in your bowel pattern. So you see, those are just like the other ones. It says also you can actually have your blood checked just like you can for ovarian cancer, for this particular cancer, using a tumor marker. And we'll talk about those in a little bit. And then they said also another common type of cancer, very similar to ovarian cancer, is something called fallopian tube cancer. And again, this is a rare cancer. It's very similar to the epithelial ovarian cancer, and it begins in the fallopian tube. So this is basically the fallopian tube is the tube that carries the egg from the ovary to the uterus, okay? And like PPC, so like the peritoneal cancer, fallopian tube cancer and ovarian cancer have similar symptoms. The treatment for fallopian tube cancer is much like that for ovarian cancer, but the outlook is slightly better, it says. Okay, so then they have all these different types of tumors. And these are just like different variations of tumors that you can develop. There's a whole host of them. So we'll talk about those. Talk about ovarian cysts and these other types. But one particular type of cell tumor that I was really concerned about, it's called a granulosa cell tumor. And this is a very rare form of ovarian cancer. So we have the standard ovarian cancer, but then this is a rare form of it. And so it has a whole different set of symptoms, and it's really important to be aware of these symptoms because it's a very rare ovarian tumor. Again, it's called a granulosa cell tumor, or GCT, and they're in the stromal cell group, which we'll talk about, the stromal cells. We'll get to those. It's in the stromal cell group, and it presents the following symptoms. And I found this really interesting for this. It had it broke down in three different types, so kind of where women are as far as in their reproduction, okay, in their reproduction health. So for women, postmenopausal women, so women that have already undergone postmenopause, they're already done with menopause, they have the following symptoms for this. This is for the granulosa cell tumor. They have abdominal uterine bleeding. They also have diagnosis of endometrial hyperplasia, which is known as the thickening of the uterus that can cause bleeding, or endometrial cancer. They experience breast tenderness. They experience vaginal secretions. and they also experience virilizing symptoms. And this is due to the increase of testosterone. So what this basically means is when a woman starts to show male pattern traits like facial hair. Now that should sound familiar because virilizing symptoms are very similar to PCOS. Okay, so those are the symptoms that you'll find, the hair growth, and the some women have changes in their voice and other things. So these are, this is a sign also of a form of ovarian cancer known as caused by granulosa cell tumors. Also, in premenopausal women, so this is women that have not had menopause yet, so they still have a menstrual period, they can experience increased abdominal girth. So remember, again, this is where your belly size increases or your abdomen enlarges. You can actually have an enlarging abdominal mass, so a mass in your abdomen. They can also experience period irregularities. Now, in prepubertal girls, so these are girls that have not advanced to puberty yet, these girls tend to have an early onset of puberty. So 70 to 80% of them have early puberty, and many of them have early male trait characteristics. So again, they have the virilizing symptoms, and this again is due to increased testosterone. Now, we talked about this last week about a whole organization that supports adolescents and the risk factors involved with developing PCOS. So again, you can see the link here. So it sounds to me, one could infer that a risk of PCOS is a risk of developing these cancers because of the traits. There's a possibility of development of tumors and complications. Okay. Now, it says here, much like other cancers, that early detection of ovarian cancer can save women's lives. Okay. This is what was really scary to me, is that no screening test exists that can tell all women whether they have ovarian cancer. And what was so important, they kept stressing this over and over again, every research that I looked at. So American Cancer Society, there is an organization for American for ovarian cancer called OCRFA, which is the Ovarian Cancer Research Fund Alliance. There's also a wonderful organization called TealWalk.org, and they have some wonderful wonderful resources. And I love the TealWalk.org because the teal just stands for something beautiful. And I just found this amazing. The TealWalk stands for the color teal, but it says teal stands for tell every amazing lady. And I thought that was really awesome because it's really through the knowledge and the information that will really help bring awareness to this condition and hopefully help someone be detected in its early stage. And so it's going to be through knowing symptoms, knowing your body, and through early detection that you can really improve your outlook of beating this cancer. So it says here that the Pap test does not test for ovarian cancer, which really just scared me because I really did assume up until this point that that's one of the main important things about a Pap test. I just naturally assumed that it's testing you for cervical cancer, so heck, it must be testing you for ovarian cancer. Well, that's not true. The Pap test is strictly for cervical cancer. It's not a screening for ovarian cancer. Okay. Not only, it says, do researchers need to develop an early detection for ovarian cancer, so they don't have an early detection tool at this time, ladies, to screen you. And some of the early detection tools that are used are the Pap tests and mammograms for breast cancer. But it also says here that women and medical professionals also need to become more aware of the cancer symptoms. So it says, with no reliable early detection for all women, several tests exist for women who are at high risk. And if a woman has ovarian cancer symptoms, a strong family history or genetic predisposition, such as something called a BRCA mutation, doctors may monitor her with one of the three tests or a combination of them. And so we'll kind of talk about early detection and some of the risk factors, and we'll talk about that BRCA mutation. I'm going to take a quick break and give some acknowledgement to our sponsors. As you know, our program and our entire network is brought to us by Digital Guard. Digital Guard is a wonderful service that allows you to monitor your home, monitor your businesses, monitor your neighborhoods. And I really think that their service is really at the forefront because it's kind of taking your traditional monitoring and it's expanding on that. Because you have the ability to do things like set up neighborhood watches. And so these are like virtual neighborhood watches. It's really affordable. There's lots of different payment options. And it's monitoring instead of just an alarm system. So it's like ongoing monitoring and support that you have to keep your neighborhood safe, to keep your businesses safe, to keep your loved ones safe. So I really do think it's a wonderful resource and it's something worth looking into. And they really are making an effort to take back our communities and improve our communities and really kind of build on that sense of community that I think in this day and age that we really have lost as a society. You know, we don't have Big Mama sitting on the porch anymore watching out for us, and our neighbor isn't looking out for our children. People are so busy right now with their technology and busy with their own lives that a lot of times we forget to look out for each other, a lot of basic decency. And so I think a lot of times we've lost that sense of community. So I really do applaud their efforts and really bringing back that sense of community and things like the neighborhood watch and really looking out for each other. So I'll take a quick break. You listen to the commercial from Digital Guard, and then we will come right back and talk about early detection. We'll talk about the mutation, the BRCA. There's actually more than one variation of that. We'll talk about some statistics, and also I found it really interesting, some really famous faces that actually lost their battle with ovarian cancer. So we'll be back in about a minute.
Did you know that most burglaries occur between the hours of 10 a.m. and 3 p.m.? Home alarm systems don't prevent burglaries. Alarm companies call the police after a break-in occurs. Be proactive. Get a Digital Guard wireless HD home camera system with monitoring. We offer two convenient purchasing options. You can purchase your very own system today for as low as $684.63, or lease a system with no credit check for just $275 down and 14 monthly payments of $50. So don't wait. Call Digital Guard today at 888-640-577-2, and don't forget to mention the promo code Nicole. That number again is 888-640-5777-2, because what you can't see will hurt you.
Hi, and welcome back to tonight's edition of Healthy 365. I'm your host, Nicole Lee, and tonight we're talking about ovarian cancer. And we went over some of the symptoms and the importance of early diagnosis, but the most important point that we really discussed was the fact that the typical woman gets a wellness exam with her gynecologist, or you could even have it with your health provider. So your nurse practitioner or your primary care physician can perform a pap smear. And unbeknownst to me, I did not realize that the pap test does not screen for ovarian cancer. It is a screening for cervical cancer. In fact, there is currently not a screening test for ovarian cancer. So the way that it's diagnosed or detected is symptoms that women will notice in their bodies. And so it's important that women know the symptoms of ovarian cancer so that they can discuss these with their health providers, primarily their gynecologist. One of the reasons, too, I remember about 6 years ago, I was driving home, I think, and talking to a friend of mine who was a coworker. And she told me, she said, you know, there's some studies out here that say that women don't have to have a pap smear every year. And I thought to myself, huh, you know, since when? They always say that you need a pap smear every year for cervical cancer screening. Well, they come with this whole movement or whatever. I don't know what this really is about. I'm sure it has something to do with the insurance industry, where women, if your pap test has been normal and there's no signs of cervical cancer, there's no need for you to have the screening done every year. That's not necessary for you to have that done. And I remember thinking to myself, if that is a part of like my wellness exam and that's my right, nobody's going to tell me that I can't have a pap exam. I mean, how would we spot any changes. You know, my doctor gives me a breast exam. They do a rectal exam. They do a vaginal exam. We find changes. Like, why would I not adhere to that? It's like a common practice in my life. But some women really hate it. I mean, it is uncomfortable. Someone, you know, scraping around in your vagina, it can be uncomfortable. But the bottom line is, pap smears save lives. You know, they help you get diagnosed with, get diagnosed with changes to your cervical, to your body. They can also help with, like I said, it's a thorough breast exam that's included. You know, your doctor does a breast exam. They can check for lumps. You can talk with your doctor. They stress that you should do monthly breast exams. It's a time to really talk to someone about your reproductive system, about changes. That's when you can bring up changes that you may experience. You know, this has changed, that has changed, I've noticed this. You know, they can see if there's some change in the appearance of your lady parts. That's so important. So I just want to tell everybody, I know that there's fads and sometimes there are outside influences about our health, but to me, it's more important than ever for us to really be at the forefront of our health. So please, ladies, get your pap smear every year. You know, do your monthly breast exams. You know, stay on track with things like the recommended mammograms and the colonoscopies so that you really are building that relationship with your provider. You know, yeah, okay, every year you have a great pap smear. Well, that's great. At least you know that there aren't any complications. You don't want to go 3 years because your insurance provider says, oh, statistics show you're okay if the last few paps have been okay. Well, here we have where ovarian cancer is not even screened through the pap. So you really do, you're entitled to that benefit. It's covered, okay, whether you have the insurance through the health market, okay, whether you have commercial insurance, whether you have Medicare, whether you have Medicaid, it's okay. You heard that the common age of diagnosis, okay, was 55 to 64. Was the highest rates, I'm sorry, were 55 to 64, and the median age of diagnosis was 63, okay? Don't fall into that bracket, and I hear this a lot, our older women and people making them feel like because they're not of childbearing age anymore and they're way past menopause, you know, they just assume, oh, you're older, so, you know, they make them kind of feel like, okay, well, your vagina is okay. No, no, no. It still is a risk of things like cervical cancer, ovarian cancer, all these different things. So get your screenings, ladies. You're entitled to that. Like I said, get your mammograms, get your colonoscopies, get your pap smears. Have a relationship with your doctor. Don't feel like because you're a certain age or because some crap from, you know, from influence from insurance companies because they don't want to pay, whatever that's really about. I hate to put that out there, but, you know, I don't really know what would be the motivation behind that. But I was just appalled. I remember telling her, no, you go get your pap smear. You know, you get it because it's yours. It's your right. It's just almost like them saying, oh, you have all your teeth and you're an adult and you haven't had any cavities, so we don't really need to see you to have oral exams. You know, oral cancer, something we'll talk about in the future, the risk about that and everything. And so part of what your dentist and hygienist is supposed to be doing is screening your mouth for oral cancers and throat cancers and things. So please do all of your routine wellness checks. You know, I can't stress that enough. It really does help build that relationship. And when else are you going to talk to somebody about, you know, your vagina or about your abdominal pain or about symptoms you've experienced, about vaginal dryness? I mean, hell, you don't have to suffer with vaginal dryness. You can talk to your doctor about that. There's some natural remedies and some other things that you can do, and also can, you know, you'll learn that, hey, that's a normal part of development after menopause, you know? Okay. So there's different types of ovarian cancer. I don't want to go in too much depth about it. I found this with the Ovarian Cancer Research Fund. They kind of just wrapped everything up in a nice little bow, and it didn't go too in-depth. But for those that want to go very much in-depth with all the big medical terms and everything, I will include links in my blog. And again, my blog is found at our social network, which is www.victimstoppers.us. And it has my blog from the night. It includes wonderful links to resources where you can find information. It has like organizations, ways you can get involved, ways to find out more information, all kinds of things. So all the research and everything that I do, it'll have all the links and things that we talked about. So there are, it says about 90% of ovarian cancers develop in the epithelium, okay? And this usually occurs in postmenopausal women. So if you look, like we just talked about that statistic, the median age of diagnosis is 63, one would infer, postmenopausal women. Also, the highest rates of women are age 55 to 64, and the median age of death is 70. So this is right links up with about 90% of ovarian cancers are in the epithelium, and this affects the postmenopausal women, okay? Now, the germ cell carcinoma tumors are another type, and they make up about 5% of the cases. So the common one, 90% of the cases, are epithelial tumors, and 5% are something called germ cell carcinoma tumors. And this begins in the cells that form the egg. So we talked about this a little bit earlier. And with germ cell carcinomas, they can occur in women of any age, but they're most often found in women in their early 20s. Now, there's six main kinds of germ cell carcinomas, but the three most common ones are called teratomas, dysgerminomas, I'm probably not saying this right at all, endodermal sinus tumors. Let me say that again. Teratomas, dysgerminomas, and endodermal sinus tumors, okay? Many tumors that arise in the germ cells are benign. So these are those ones that we talked about developing younger women. They tend to be benign. Now, we talked about the rare cancer, okay, the one that scared me a little bit, the one called granulosa cell tumors. And remember I said it's in the stromal cell group, and it's a very rare cancer. Okay, it's a very rare tumor, I'm sorry. Okay, so this is a generalization of that type of tumor, okay? They're called stromal carcinoma tumors. Now, these ovarian stromal carcinoma tumors account for 5%. So much like the germ cells, these account for 5%, okay, of ovarian cancer cases. It can develop in the connective tissue cells that hold the ovary together, and also those that produce hormones for females, such as estrogen and progesterone. The two most common types are called granulosa cell tumors, we talked about those, and Sertoli-Leydig cell tumors. What makes these different is 70% of the stromal carcinoma cases are diagnosed in stage one. So that's favorable because they're in stage one. And remember when we talked about the stages, remember, of how something is staged, we got that from the American Cancer Society's page on about stages. Remember, that tells us kind of like where the, you know, what stage the cancer is in. Remember, there are stages 1, 2, and 3. Okay, so that's a good sign because it means it's treatable. You know, there's probably more success with it being treated if you can find it in stage one. Okay, so that should bring about hope to everybody. Okay, there's also something called small cell carcinoma of the ovary. Now, small cell carcinoma of the ovary, or SCCO, is a rare tumor. It's highly malignant that affects mainly young women. Again, this is something that affects young women. It says the median age for diagnosis of this type of tumor is age 24. Now, there's different types of SCCOs. They include pulmonary, neuroendocrine, and hypercalcemic, okay? SCCO accounts for 0.1% of ovarian cancer cases, and approximately two-thirds of patients with SCCO have hypercalcemia. These symptoms are the same as other types of ovarian cancer, which we kind of talked about that, and they have a detailed guide. Now, let's kind of go into, because I've said stage more than once, so let's talk about staging and grading, okay? Now, in order to make a definitive diagnosis of ovarian cancer, a gynecologic oncologist must perform surgery to gather some samples. So they're going to go inside and they're going to gather some samples and they're going to send the samples off to a pathologist, okay? A pathologist is someone who can analyze tissues, okay? During the surgeon may assess how far the disease has spread. So while they're inside where they're gathering the tissue samples, okay, they're going to take a look about what's going on? Okay, this is the origin of the cancer. It spread to here, here, and here, okay? This assessment is called staging, okay? Along with staging, they also do something called grading, and we'll talk about that. And these are assessments that help the doctor recommend a treatment plan. So the gynecologic oncologist, okay, he is collecting the tissue samples. So he's looking around, he or she is looking around, and they're kind of assessing where the tumor originated from and how far it spread. So that assessment, again, is called staging and grading. Now, staging in ovarian cancer and other gynecologic cancers has been standardized by something called the International Federation of Gynecology and Obstetrics. Okay? Now, the FIGO, okay, which is Federation of Gynecology and Obstetrics, it's the most important predictor of long-term survival. So this is important because this kind of gives you an indication of your rate of survival. Okay, so let's talk about the different stages, okay? And stage one of ovarian cancer, cancer cells are found in one or both ovaries. Cancer cells may be found on the surface of the ovaries or in fluid collected from the abdomen. And remember, fluid in the abdomen is called ascites. At this stage, cancer cells have not spread to other organs and tissues in the abdomen or pelvis, lymph nodes, or distant sites, okay? So it didn't spread. It's within the surface or the fluid area in the abdomen, okay? Now, there's different stages, and guys, this gets way complicated, so I'm just going to kind of briefly touch on them, and then, like I said, I'll leave links. There's, like, of stage one, there's all these subcategories. So there's stage 1A, there's stage 1B, and there's stage 1C. Okay, so 1A means it's got limited development in either one ovary or the fallopian tube, where the outer ovarian capsule is not ruptured. There's no tumor on the external surface of the ovary, and there's no ascites or the washings are negative. Okay, 1B, the cancer is present in both ovaries or fallopian tubes, but the outer capsule is intact, and there is no tumor or external surface. There's no ascites, and the washings are negative. 1C, the cancer is either stage 1A or 1B, but the capsule is ruptured. Okay, this is what makes this one different. It actually is ruptured, and there is a tumor on the ovarian surface, or malignant cells are present in the ascites. Okay, that's in the abdominal fluid or washings. 15% of all cases of ovarian cancer are diagnosed with stage one. Okay. Now, for the prognosis and survival rates, they give it based on this stage. So stage just one, and this is, remember, their survival rates are based on a 5-year. Okay. So they do it by 5 years. So stage one has 90% of a 5-year survival rate. Stage 1A has a 94%. Okay. Stage 1B has a 92%, and stage 1C has 85%. Now, generally, women with stage 1, the treatments that they recommend are a total abdominal hysterectomy. So that means removal of both ovaries and fallopian tubes. They call this a salpingo-oophorectomy, okay? An omnectomy, okay, or removal of the omentum, a sheet of fat that covers some abdominal organs, and a biopsy of lymph nodes and other tissues in the pelvis and abdomen. So they do the total hysterectomy, okay? They do an omnectomy, and then they biopsy pieces of the lymph nodes and other tissue in the pelvis and abdomen. And this is to make sure that it didn't spread. And remember, when a cancer spreads, that's called metastasize, okay? Now, women of childbearing age who wish to preserve their fertility and whose disease is confined to one ovary may be treated by a unilateral salpingo oophorectomy without a hysterectomy. An omnectomy and the other parts of the staging procedure are still performed, depending on the pathologist's interpretation. And again, the pathologist is the doctor that studies the tissue samples, what's moved, removed surgically by the gynecologist, I'm sorry, you guys. Depending on their interpretation, okay, of the tissues, they're going to assess and study these tissues. There may be no further treatment if the cancer is low grade, or if the tumor is high grade, the patient may receive a combination chemotherapy. Okay? Now, let's take a look at stage two. Okay? Stage two, okay, and this is just staging, okay? And stage two ovarian cancer, cancer cells have spread from one or both ovaries to other tissues in the pelvis. And cancer cells are found on the fallopian tubes, the uterus, the bladder, the sigmoid colon, okay, so it's spread down to the GI tract, the gastrointestinal tract, or rectum in the pelvis. Cancer cells may be found in fluid collected from the abdomen. Again, remember the fluid in the abdomen is ascites, right? Now, they have these staged, again, in three subcategories. 2A is an extension or implant, meaning the cancer has extended or implanted onto the uterus and the fallopian tubes. And the washings are negative washings, and there is no ascites, okay? So there's no fluid in the abdomen, okay? Stage 2B is an extension or implant into the pelvic tissues, and the washings are negative, and there's no ascites, okay? Stage 2C is there is an extension to the pelvic region, or it implants much like 2A or B, but it has positive pelvic washings. Again, it's positive in the ascites in the abdomen. It says that stage 2 ovarian cancer is a small group. It comprises 19% of ovarian cancer diagnosis, okay? Now, here's the prognosis and survival rate. Again, it says for all types of ovarian cancer taken together, about 3 in 4 women with ovarian cancer live for at least 1 year after one diagnosis. Almost half, which is 46.2% of women with ovarian cancer, are still alive at least 5 years after diagnosis. When women are diagnosed when they are younger than 65, they do better than older women, okay? Because you know when you're older, you can have some additional complications that they take into account, okay? Most women diagnosed with stage 2 ovarian cancer have a 5-year survival rate of approximately 70%. So that 5-year survival rate is 70%, okay? Stage 2A has a 78% 5-year survival rate. Stage 2B has a 73%. And remember that last stage we talked on where it has the extension to the pelvis region? It also has an implantation like stage 2A and B, and then it has positive in the ascites and the fluids in the abdomen. Well, unfortunately, that survival rate of 2C is 57%. Okay, now the recommended treatments for stage 2 are going to be hysterectomy, a bilateral salpingo-oophorectomy, so that's removal of both ovaries and the fallopian tube. So you're going to have hysterectomy, okay, and they're going to remove your ovaries and your fallopian tubes. They'll also do something called debulking of as much of the tumor as possible, and they'll take a sample of the lymph nodes and other tissues in the pelvis and the abdomen, especially if they suspect these tissues of harboring cancer. After the surgical procedure, treatment may be one of the following. They'll do combination chemotherapy with or without radiation or combination chemotherapy. And we'll kind of talk about treatments as well. Let's take a look because there's 4 stages, okay? So let's look at stage 3. Let me check our time there. You guys know I'm a big talker, okay? Okay, so stage 3. Okay, in stage 3, cancer cells have spread to tissues outside the pelvis or to regional lymph nodes in the back of the abdomen, so that's called retroperitoneal lymph nodes, and cancer cells may be found on the outside of the liver, okay? So there's 3 different subcategories, okay? So there's stage 3A. This is largely a tumor that is confined to the pelvis, but with microscopic peritoneal metastasis beyond pelvis to abdominal peritoneal surfaces on the omentum, okay? Stage 3B is the same as 3A, but it has macroscopic peritoneal or omental metastasis beyond the pelvis, less than 2 centimeters. So there's, you know, stage 3C is the same as 2A, but it has peritoneal or omental metastasis beyond the pelvis, larger than 2 centimeters. So this is a mass larger than 2 centimeters. Or it has lymph node metastasis to the inguinal, pelvic, or para or aortic areas. The cancer may also spread to the lymph nodes, but it has not spread to the inside of the liver or the spleen or distant sites. Now, 60% of all cases of ovarian cancer are diagnosed with stage 3. So that's a really high. That's higher than 2 and 1. So it's 60%, okay? Here's some information on survival rates. It says for, again, it talks about for all rates, 3 and 4 women with ovarian cancer live for at least a year. 46% are still alive 5 years later. Okay, it says most women diagnosed with stage 3 ovarian cancer have a 5-year survival rate of 39%. So as you can see, as the stages increase, okay, so does the severity, and unfortunately, survival rates decrease, okay? So stage 3, there's a 5-year survival rate of 39%. Stage 3A, there's a 59% survival rate. Stage 3B, the survival rate is 52%, and the stage 3C is a 39% survival rate. Now, the treatment for stage 3 is the same as stage 2, okay? So they do a hysterectomy, a bilateral salpingo-oophorectomy, which is the removal of ovaries and fallopian tubes. They also do a debulking of as much of the tumor as possible. They also sample some of the lymph nodes and other tissues in the pelvis and abdomen that are suspected of harboring the cancer. And after surgery, the patient may either receive combination chemotherapy followed by additional surgery to find and remove any remaining cancer. Okay, let's talk about stage 4, okay? All right, stage 4 ovarian cancer, it means the cancer cells have spread to tissues outside the abdomen and pelvis. Cancer cells may be found inside the spleen, inside the liver, in the lungs, and in other organs, okay? So when you hear stage 4, you know this means the cancer has really spread, okay? Located outside the peritoneal cavity. Now, there's two different stages here. So there's stage 4A, which means that cancer cells are found in the fluid around the lungs. This is called a malignant pleural effusion, okay, with no other areas of cancer spread outside the pelvis or the peritoneal cavity. Stage 4B, the cancer has spread to the inside of the spleen or liver, to lymph nodes, besides the retroperitoneal lymph nodes. Remember, there's lymph nodes throughout your body, and so it's to lymph nodes besides the retroperitoneal lymph nodes, and or to other organs or tissues outside the peritoneal cavity. This includes the lungs, the brain, and the skin. And this is one of those rare, remember they said they don't often spread to the lungs, the brain, and the skin. So the staging is pretty severe for 4, okay? Now, prognosis and survival rates. It says most women diagnosed with stage 4 ovarian cancer have a 5-year survival rate of approximately 17%. So it has the lowest survival rate, period. They don't break it down by stages. It's just the 17% survival rate. Survival rates are often based on studies of large numbers of people, but they can't predict what will happen in any particular person's case. It's important to know that other factors impact a woman's prognosis, okay? And that prognosis, remember, means outlook, including her general health, the grade of the cancer, and how well the cancer responds to treatment, okay? Treatment for stage 4 ovarian cancer will consist of surgery to remove as much of the tumor as possible, followed by combination chemotherapy. Okay, but let's talk about grading, okay? Because remember, they don't just stage it, they also grade it. Okay, so with grading, by looking at the cells in the tissue and fluid under a microscope, okay, so this is what the pathologist does, they grade. The pathologist will be able to describe the cancer as a grade 1, 2, or 3. Grade 1 is most like ovarian tissue and less likely to spread, okay? So grade 1 is most like the ovarian tissue, okay? So it hasn't changed much, and it's less likely to spread. Grade 3, the cells are more irregular and more likely to metastasize or spread. However, many ovarian cancers are categorized simply as a low grade or a high grade. Chemotherapy is often not used to treat low grade stage 1 cases, okay? And so then we talked about grade two was in between 1 and 3. Remember, it had characters. It was like right in between. All right, so we'll talk about that. Let me take a quick break. We'll do a quick interlude with some music, and then we'll kind of wrap things up. We'll kind of look in depth a little bit about chemotherapy and radiation. We'll also talk about some famous people. Some you may know, you may be too young to know, or you just don't really know them. Some you may have heard of before. I found the list very interesting. There were about 50 beautiful women on the list that actually had lost their battle with ovarian cancer. So we'll talk about that. We'll also talk about some statistics and the difference between women of African-American descent that actually their risk for the condition. So we'll talk a little bit about that as well. Today's edition of Healthy 365. I'm your host, Nicole Lee, and today we're talking about ovarian cancer, and we just talked about staging and grading. And staging is what the gynecological oncologist, what they see when they are doing the surgery to get samples so that they can kind of assess the severity of the cancer. Staging is basically where it has spread to. They also try to determine an origin. They take samples. They send those samples to a pathologist. The pathologist then grades it, which means the likelihood that it'll spread. And then we talked about that. And I'll include links to the blogs. I know it's a lot of information when we're talking about these health things. And so I don't expect you to remember any of this. What I did want to talk about before we kind of run out of time, I want to talk about some of the risks that I noticed, the differences in African-American women and non-African-American women. So there was a study that talked about the likelihood of a woman developing it based on based on their race. So there are many risk factors that showed some similar relations across the board. So across race, ethnic groups, there were some common risks and some common risk factors. One of which was tubal ligation. So if you tie your tubes, okay. Family history of breast cancer or ovarian cancer. And so those were the highest associations of incidence of ovarian cancer for African-American women. It was having a tubal ligation, having a familial history of breast or ovarian cancer were the strongest associations. Younger ages were associated with Caucasian women. Also, there was risk factors associated with oral contraception, obesity, and we'll talk about some more of those. But they need more research about the etiological factors for ovarian cancer in African American women. But many of it was, you know, across the board, but there were some high risk. So let's kind of talk about the risk of developing ovarian cancer. Okay, so we talked about something where we're looking for like a gene mutation. So these are genetic. There's some blood tests that they can do called a BRCA1 and a BRCA2. So about 20 to 25% of women diagnosed with ovarian cancer have a hereditary tendency to develop the disease. Some of you may have heard about that because there's a very famous woman that actually did a double mastectomy. It was elective based on her genetic testing for this condition. And the actress that I'm talking about is Angelina Jolie. Okay, so she actually tested, had a genetic mutation, so she actually removed her breast. It was an elective double mastectomy to reduce her risk of developing breast cancer, and now we see the link between breast cancer and development of ovarian cancer. So it says about 20 to 25% of women diagnosed with ovarian cancer have a hereditary tendency to develop the disease. The most significant risk factor for ovarian cancer is an inherited genetic mutation, and it is called BRCA1 or BRCA2. These genes are responsible for about 10 to 15% of all ovarian cancers. It says that Eastern European women and women of Ashkenazi Jewish descent are at a higher risk of carrying BRCA1 and BRCA2 mutations. Since these genes are linked to both breast and ovarian cancer, women who have had breast cancer have an increased risk of developing ovarian cancer. And there will be more detailed information, and I'll include that link. Now, there's also something called a genetic Lynch syndrome. This is another long genetic known genetic link to ovarian cancer, and it is an inherited syndrome called hereditary non-polyposis colorectal cancer, or HNPCC, or Lynch syndrome. While HNPCC poses the greatest risk of development of colorectal cancer, women with HNPCC have about a 12% lifetime risk of developing ovarian cancer and a 40 to 60% chance of developing uterine cancer. Okay? Another risk factor is going to be your family history. Women with a grandmother, a mother, daughter, or sister with ovarian cancer with no known genetic mutations still have an increased risk of developing ovarian cancer. The lifetime risk of a woman who has a first-degree relative with ovarian cancer is 5%. The average woman's lifetime risk is 1.4%. So you can see how it increases that risk significantly. While it accounts for only a limited number of cases, heredity is a strong risk factor for ovarian cancer. Maternal and family history should be considered. However, many women without a family history may still have a gene mutation associated with the risk for ovarian cancer. All women diagnosed with ovarian cancer, primary peritoneal or fallopian tube cancer, should be referred for genetic counseling and consideration of genetic testing. Family history of any of the following cancers may also indicate an increased risk. So any family history of breast cancer, ovarian cancer, colon cancer, uterine cancer, and rectal cancer puts you at greater risk, okay? A personal history of cancer or endometriosis. And remember, we kind of just touched slightly on endometriosis when we were talking about PCOS, okay? So women who have had cancer of the breast, uterus, colon, or rectum have a higher risk of ovarian cancer, but having endometriosis increases the risk of clear cell and endometrioid ovarian cancers 2 to 3-fold, so 2 to 3 times at risk if you have endometriosis, okay? Increasing age. All women are at risk of developing ovarian cancer regardless of age. However, ovarian cancer rates are higher in women 55 to 64. The median age which women are diagnosed, we talked about, was 63, meaning half of women are younger than 63 when diagnosed with ovarian cancer and half are older. Also, what can put you at risk is a reproductive history and infertility. Research currently suggests a relationship between the number of menstrual cycles in a woman's lifetime and her risk of developing ovarian cancer. A woman is at an increased risk if she started menstruating at an early age, so before the age of 12, is a risk, okay? Has not given birth to any children, puts you at increased risk. had her first child after 30 puts you at increased risk. Experienced menopause after 50 puts you at increased risk. Has never taken oral contraceptives puts you at increased risk. Having infertility, regardless of whether or not a woman uses fertility drugs, also increases the risk of ovarian cancer. Also something, and many of you women may be, you know, familiar with this, hormone replacement therapy. It says that doctors may prescribe hormone replacement therapy to alleviate symptoms associated with menopause. Some of those common symptoms are hot flashes, night sweats, sleeplessness, vaginal dryness. That occurs as the body adjusts to decreased levels of estrogen, okay? Hormone replacement therapy usually involves treatment with either estrogen alone for women who have had a hysterectomy or a combination of estrogen with progesterone or progestin for women who have not had a hysterectomy. Women who use menopausal hormonal therapy are at increased risk for ovarian cancer. And so recent studies indicate that using a combination of estrogen and progestin for 5 or more years significantly increases the risk of ovarian cancer in women who have had a hysterectomy. 10 or more years of estrogen use increases the risk of ovarian cancer in women who have had a hysterectomy. Obesity, we keep touching on this, it increases. There's a study that found a link between obesity and ovarian cancer. A 2009 study found that obesity was associated with an almost 80% higher risk of ovarian cancer in women. 50 to 71 who had not taken hormones after menopause. So if you don't take hormones, replacement therapy, and you're between the ages of 50 to 71 and you're obese, it increases your risk by 80%, okay? Reducing the risk. You can reduce your risk of developing ovarian cancer in multiple ways. There's no prevention method for the disease. However, all women are at risk because ovarian cancer does not strike only one ethnic or age group. A healthcare professional can help a woman identify ways to reduce her risk as well as decide if consultation with the genetic counselor is appropriate. Okay, so oral contraceptive use. The use of oral contraceptives, which we talked about that last week to treat PCOS, decreases the risk of developing ovarian cancer, especially when used for several years. Women who use oral contraceptives for 5 or more years have about a 50% lower risk of developing ovarian cancer than women who have never used oral contraceptives. If you breastfed, so pregnancy and breastfeeding are linked with a reduced risk of ovarian cancer, likely because women ovulate less frequently when pregnant or breastfeeding. Multiple pregnancies or having first full-term pregnancy before the age of 26 also decreases the risk. Removal of the ovaries and fallopian tubes. Women can greatly reduce their risk of ovarian cancer by removing their ovaries and fallopian tubes, a procedure known as prophylactic bilateral saphenoophorectomy. Primary peritoneal cancer, which is microscopically about identical to ovarian cancer, can still occur. Okay. This is one recent study suggests that women with BRCA1 mutations can gain the most benefit by removing their ovaries before the age of 35. So someone that has that gene mutation, the BRCA1, if they go ahead and have their ovaries and fallopian tubes removed before the age of 35, they improve their chances of not developing ovarian cancer. Having a hysterectomy and tubal ligation. Having a hysterectomy or removal of the uterus while leaving the ovaries may decrease the risk of ovarian cancer by 33%, according to the American Cancer Society. Having fallopian tubes tied or tubal ligation may reduce risk by up to 67%, says the American Cancer Society, although they're not sure why this is. So there's still a lot not known about like your risk factors and kind of why certain things work and things like that. Reoccurrence. Let's talk about reoccurrence. If a cancer returns after a period of remission, so remission means you are cancer-free, that is considered a recurrence. A cancer recurrence happens because some cancer cells were left behind and eventually grow and become apparent. The cancer may come back to the same place as the original tumor or to another place in the body. Around 70% of patients diagnosed with ovarian cancer will have a reoccurrence. So that's really high. There's a really high reoccurrence rate. This is one of the factors in determining a patient's risk of reoccurrence is the stage of the cancer at diagnosis. So we talked about the stages. Stage 1, they have a 10% chance of reoccurrence. Stage 2 has a 30% chance of reoccurrence. Stage 3 has a 70 to 90% chance of reoccurrence. And finally, stage 4 have a 90 to 95% of reoccurrence. It says recurrent ovarian cancer is treatable, but rarely curable. Women with recurrent ovarian cancer may have to undergo another surgery. Because many women with recurrent ovarian cancer receive chemotherapy for a long period of time, and sometimes continuously, the toxicities of the therapy are a major factor in treatment decisions. So treatment for recurrence, it says the effectiveness and type of treatment for recurrent cancer depends on what kind of chemotherapy the patient received in the past. So they'll take a look and they kind of break it all down. And we have only 15 minutes left, so I don't want to go too deep off into recurrence, but let's talk a little bit about the treatments, okay? Because I know we touched on chemotherapy a little bit and radiation, okay? The standard treatment for ovarian cancer consists of something called a debulking surgery, followed by 6 rounds of chemotherapy, okay? One recent study found that just 37% of women received the standard treatment. So only 37%, wow. Despite the evidence that this is the most effective. So the most effective treatment, they said, is debulking surgery, okay? That's where they remove the tumor, okay, as much of the tumor as possible, and then they do 6 rounds of chemotherapy, okay? The goal of treatment for ovarian cancer is to surgically remove as much of the cancer as possible through the debulking and then to provide what is called adjuvant or additional therapy such as chemotherapy to kill any remaining cancer cells in the body. Radiation therapy, which uses high energy rays to kill cancer cells, is not typically utilized in ovarian cancer. So the typical treatment is 6 rounds of chemotherapy, okay, and then the surgical removal of as much as of the tumor and the cancer cells as possible, okay? And then I'll include some links to tips about after diagnosis, how to find clinical trials, information, and resources for patients. There's a national conference. There's a wonderful link called Woman to Woman. There's some wonderful walks, like there's a teal walk that they have every year. Again, Ovarian Cancer Awareness Month is September of every year. Here's some really important questions that they suggest that you consider asking your doctor early in treatment. So if you get diagnosed with ovarian cancer, here's some of the things that you want to ask. You want to ask, what is the stage of my disease? You want to ask, has the cancer spread from my ovaries? And if so, where did it spread to? Okay. You want to ask, what are my treatment choices? Do you recommend intraperitoneal chemotherapy for me and why or why not? You want to also ask them, would a clinical trial be appropriate for you? Also ask, will I need more than one kind of treatment? Ask them, what are the expected benefits of each kind of treatment? Ask, what are the risks and possible side effects of each treatment? And what can we do to control the side effects? Will they go away after a treatment ends? What can I do to prepare for treatment? How long will I need to stay in the hospital? Can I get chemotherapy at my local hospital since it's too far to drive to a major medical center? Ask them, what is the treatment likely to cost? Will my insurance cover the cost? Ask, how will treatment affect my normal activities? Ask, will treatment cause me to go through early menopause? Ask them, will I be able to get pregnant and have children after treatment? And also ask, how often should I have checkups after treatment? If you don't feel comfortable with a doctor or you want to seek a second opinion about your care, you have every right to do so, okay? And then there's also different types of chemotherapy, there's different types of drugs, there's clinical trials, all these different things. We'll include all the information about the treatments in my wonderful blog. Again, that's found on www.victimstoppers.us. I would love for everyone to tune in next week, same time from 7 to 8. Eastern Standard Time. We're on Standard Time now, where I will be discussing hospice and palliative care and trying to address some of the benefits of this wonderful form of care. I'm very passionate about hospice care. I worked for a hospice provider for a number of years, and it just really opened my eyes up to why it's so important to have this treatment for patients. So it's amazing. So we'll talk about that and also ways to break down the stigma and how important it is to get the care as much as possible. Palliative care is a growing care, a level of care. And so you don't find as many options. There are some like home health providers that provide it, but we'll kind of dig into that next week. Also be sure to tune in to Moving Forward. It's hosted by Duane Abernathy, and it's broadcasted Monday evenings from 8 to 10 Eastern Standard Time. And then Thursday nights, be sure to check out Against All Odds, which is a segment hosted by both Renita Graves and Ayana Muhammad. And that segment airs from 8 to 9 p.m. on the network, okay? Don't forget to join victimstoppers.us, which is a wonderful social network where you can set up a neighborhood watch. You can talk about different things. You can find out what's going on with the host. You can also join a social network called Yizer, www.yizer.com. And it is a social site that has information about savings and some other things. I know there's some great recipes there. My blog, though, and the other host blogs are all on Victim Stoppers. So I would start there. I want to thank all of you so much for sharing this time with me. And I always like to end our week with some positivity. And I would like to share a quote for one of my sheroes. I love her. I mean, my dream to be a journalist was because I got to see a strong African-American woman be on daytime TV. I remember running home to see Oprah Winfrey after a long day at school. And I just would just admire. I was like, oh, she speaks so well. And look, she's just like your average common person. I just really admire her. So I actually have two quotes from her, and I really think they go hand in hand. So the first quote is, "The great courageous act that we must all do is to have the courage to step out of our history and pass so that we can live our dreams." And the next quote is, "The key to realizing a dream is to focus not on success, but on significance. And then even the small steps and little victories along your path will take on greater meaning." So I'll read both of those again. The first one was, "The great courageous act that we must all do is to have the courage to step out of our history and pass so that we can live our dreams." And it says, "The key to realizing a dream is to focus not on success, but on significance. And then even the small steps and little victories along your path will take on greater meaning." And those beautiful words were spoken by Oprah Winfrey. I want to thank all of you for joining me again. We'll have a quick word from our sponsors, but we'll have a quick little interlude of music. I look forward to seeing you all tune in next week. And I hope you have a wonderful, inspirational, and positive week ahead. Thank you. everyone. I did it again this week. I'm going to include a list of some commonly known famous people, some less known, some more known than others, who lost their battle with ovarian cancer. But just a few that really stuck out for me were Coretta Scott King, and she was the late wife of civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. Another one was Thandi Newton. Jessica Tandy. I'm so sorry, Thandi Newton. You're beautiful and you're still here. Jessica Tandy is the actress from Driving Miss Daisy. And so she lost her battle with this horrible disease. Another one is Patricia Ramsey. She's the mother of JonBenet Ramsey, the little girl that they never found out who actually murdered her. Another beautiful woman was Ann Dunham. She's the mother of 44th President of the United States, Barack Obama. Another one would be Marjorie Gross. She was a TV writer and producer on Seinfeld. There's also Helen Cresswell. She was an English writer. A Janet Margolin. She was an American actress who worked on Ghostbusters 2. There is actress Alice Pierce. She played Gladys Kravitz on Bewitched. Many of you, I may be dating myself. There's also Lorraine Ellis. She was an American soul singer. Also a Patricia Dunn. She was a non-executive chairman on the board of Hewlett Packard. There's a Julie Parrish, who was an American actress. Dinah Shore, Madeline Kahn, Rosalind Franklin. Let's see, Glenda Adams, Tomoko Kawakami. Also, where is she? I want to make sure. Where? She is, Marchlene Bertrand. She's the mother of Angelina Jolie, and she was the wife of actor John Voight. So that is, remember I said Angelina Jolie is the actress who elected for the double mastectomy because of the gene mutation that she had, and this was based on her mother's ovarian cancer diagnosis that she actually lost her battle with. Okay, so I'll include all of these wonderful names of these ladies on my blog, and I'll see you next week.
Having a camera system is not enough. We are told that surveillance cameras are effective crime-fighting tools because they deter and or record evidence of criminal activity. But this information is false. Deterrence only works on some people, not all. One only has to keep up with the news being reported from around the world, and we see day after day of overnight burglaries or smash and grabs of businesses when they're closed. And these businesses have cameras. Cameras are great to record crimes, and they give you a record after a crime is committed. Criminals don't care if they are caught on video. They only care if they get caught in the act of a crime. You may be asking, why use Digital Guard remote monitoring to protect your business or home? Why hire Digital Guard remote monitoring instead of hiring a security guard? What makes Digital Guard remote monitoring different from alarm monitoring companies? The answers to your questions are, what is the answer? The answer is Digital Guard Live Surveillance Monitoring. Digital Guard Live Surveillance Monitoring has been used to improve or replace traditional security guard services for many businesses. Our solution is a proactive and more effective way to preventing the act of a crime at less than 75% of the cost of having security guards. Digital Guard Live Surveillance Monitoring eliminates all of those associated fees that come with hiring a security guard staff. Digital Guard Live Surveillance Monitoring solves the problem of businesses burglarized overnight when they're closed. Our command center views live real-time video from any installed camera on our network. Upon viewing an attempted security breach, we can either dispatch a security response unit or immediately contact law enforcement. Digital Guard Remote Monitoring will improve safety, reduce accidents, reduce shrinkage, increase bottom line, raise staff accountability, and give business owners a sense of peace. Criminals don't care if they are caught on video. They only care if they get caught in the act of a crime. Be proactive, not reactive, when it comes to protecting your business or home. To get started, contact us at 888-640-5777, option 2, or visit www.digitalguardlive.com.